It's now announced the recording is in progress. Again, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're going to be proceeding today on our remote Zoom Gov platform. I know that the attorneys have worked through the logistics as far as being able to hear and see. If there's any issue that you experience during your argument, just wave your hand or something, or I may call it to your attention. Our clerk today is Mike McCall, our marshal, and I'm asking him to call the court to order, please.
Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Johnson, Judge Smith, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
And Mr. McCall, if you'll call the first case.
Calling A24-1815, Julianne E. Micken versus Daniel Shearschmidt.
Each of you will have 15 minutes for presentation of your case, 5 minutes is reserved for appellate rebuttal if you choose to utilize that. The time, my time camera is in my upper left-hand box. It may appear differently from you. The time will go down. Please pay attention to it. I'll call it to your attention. If you go over, I'll let you wrap up, but we do need to stay on track with the number of hearings we have today. With that said, appellant counsel, when you're ready to proceed, please indicate who you are and which party you're speaking on behalf.
May it please the court, Mr. Dahlberg. My name is Cassandra Wolfgram, and I am here today on behalf of the appellants, Daniel and Melissa Shearschmidt. We are here today on a simple issue. Did the district court err by granting relief to the respondent, Julianne Micken, when Ms. Micken failed to prove any cause of action? The only answer to that question is yes. This court will note that in the briefs, Ms. Micken tries to change the focus. Instead of responding to the issues presented, she tries to push and say that the respondent, the appellants, the Shearschmidts, did not prove affirmative defenses. Now, I want to bring this to the court's attention at the beginning because Ms. Micken was the plaintiff in the underlying case. The appellants, the Shearschmidts, were the defendants. And this is important because the Shearschmidts had no burden of proof. I'm going to start with the lack of any legal claim.
Let me, based on your brief, I think I know what you're going to say, but I want to sort of I referred back to the pleadings, the complaint and the answer, and it seems to me that plaintiff pleaded a form of relief which corresponds pretty closely with what the district court awarded. I mean the plaintiff did not allege that she was entitled to the property at the time of filing the complaint, that she had performed everything. I mean, she asked for, in her prayer for relief, sort of three stages of, she asked for an order requiring defendant to produce the payoff amount. She asked for an order requiring her to make payment of the balance, and then an order requiring defendants to deliver the warranty deed. And then in your answer, you asked for a declaration that the contract is null and void. And in your post-trial submissions, you also asked for a declaration that plaintiff is a tenant at will. I mean, given all of those requests for relief, and those which I think frame the issues, I mean, where did the district court go beyond what the parties asked for?
So, Your Honor, to begin with, the district court specifically found that Ms. Micken was not entitled to specific performance.
And where did the district court say that?
They said that actually in her order. I'm just bringing it right up to me. So she failed to meet her burden. So this was in the addendum at pages 48, 24, finding that respondent didn't meet her burden.
Yeah, that was in the order on post-trial relief, correct? Yep. I think it says that is a prevailing party not by virtue of having succeeded on her claim, but by virtue of the fact that the declaratory relief sought by the defendants and so on. And I would
and
agree with you.
She specifically also said that she denied any claim of specific performance.
I would agree with you that that paragraph provide some support for your argument. But if we look at the post-trial order from, I think, starting at addendum one, and the way that the district court analyzed the issues in its findings and conclusions, it seems like the district court was granting plaintiff the type of relief that plaintiff was asking for, and was addressing the issues and denying some of the requests that defendants were asking for.
Still goes to the problem that there wasn't a legal claim proven. And that's the basic law, is that in order to obtain relief, you have to have a legal cause of action. And so specific performance is a remedy for breach of contract. Because of that,
I have a question for you, Ms. Wolfram, because I sat and I went through this and I looked at it and I was trying to put on my own lawyer cap. In instances like this, where you have a contract for deed between two parties, they go into it, and the vendor in this case, if the vendor in this case had not delivered title, what does the vendee do? What is the mechanism, the procedural mechanism to get it before the court? Because I kept thinking, gee, I think I would have sued it out the same way. And of course, I'm not the lawyer in this. So what do you think she should have done?
She should have done is sued it out in 2011. And that's what the cases we have on abandonment discuss, and also Lewis, is that when a party breaches and they're entitled to the deed, they have to bring it at the time that they had that entitlement. So Lewis, while it's a very old case, it talks specifically about this, that what happened in this matter was Ms. Micken was supposed to make the balloon payment in April of 2011. Lewis provides very clearly that her time to bring an action began in April of 2011. She cannot obtain an indefinite expansion of that time because of the fact that she failed to perform. And so what she should have done at April of 2011 was to bring a complaint for breach of contract requesting specific performance as a remedy. She didn't do that. She didn't bring anything until 2022. And so then we get into all the issues about the statute of limitations, the statute of frauds, and abandonment. This is a person.
By that same reasoning, then, your clients back in April of 2011, when the balloon payment wasn't made, could have canceled the contract via cancellation notice and have that 60-day period to cure. So how do we overlook that when we don't overlook the purchaser's errors?
You're right. Our clients could have done that, and they did not. But that goes straight into the statute of frauds and the statute of limitations. Our clients only had
What about title? This was Torrens' property, and if you don't follow the procedural requirements, you have a title issue. So how would that have been cured?
Your Honor, that part was not addressed with the district court about any issues of the title. And so we were just talking about the claims and whether or not she had any valid claim at that time. And so we talked about a little bit on the specific performance. And Judge Johnson, you mentioned that you said it seems like she's evaluating these. But we don't even know what the claim is at this point. So in the amended order after the post-trial findings, the court said that it was some equitable claim. We don't know what equitable claim it was. The court does not explain this. We did not go to trial on this. And obviously, it's very prejudicial for the district court to say there's an equitable claim when one party doesn't know what it was and had no opportunity to defend against that. But more importantly, is even assuming that there was some equitable claim that we don't know what it was, the district court expressly found Ms. Micken came to the court with unclean hands. She also expressly found Ms. Micken materially breached the contract for deed in 2011. Those are important because of the fact that that precludes her from relief. Because she had unclean hands, she's not entitled to any equitable relief. And because she materially breached the contract for deed, the appellants, the Shireschmidts, had no further burden of proof and did not have any obligation to perform subsequent actions on that contract for deed. They have no obligation to deliver a deed because Ms. Micken materially breached by failing to perform when she was due. Your Honors, I just want to go back into this because I think it's important. Judge Johnson, you mentioned that you said it looked like the court of a, the district court was addressing multiple issues. And if you look at the pleadings, the appellants did not bring any counterclaims. The appellants brought affirmative defenses. The parties proceeded and provided post-trial memorandums about a breach of contract and about specific performance. They did not address any other equitable issues. And that's important because without Ms. Micken proving her prima facie case, there was no obligation for the appellants to prove any affirmative defenses.
But you, even, but defendants submitted proposed findings, order, and findings, conclusions, order for judgment, which I'm looking at it right now, which, you know, you're asking the district court to make certain a few paragraphs of statements to resolve plaintiff's claims. And then there's two more. One, you wanted the district court to order that the contract for deed is declared null and void. And second, you asked the district court to declare that Ms. Micken is a tenant at will. Where do what's the who pleaded those items? And, you know, why did you ask the district court to determine those issues?
Those go actually with our affirmative defenses that we were saying because of the statute of frauds and the statute of limitations that the contract for deed is void. But it again goes to there's no burden of proof on the appellants because Ms. Micken was the plaintiff. Ms. Micken had a burden of proof. And whether the appellants proved any of these affirmative defenses, which they did, is immaterial because without Ms. Micken having proven any cause of action, she's not entitled to relief. The district court does not have any authority and there's no legal support. And Ms. Micken did not provide any legal support that a district court can say, I disagree with the affirmative defenses of defendants, so I'm granting plaintiff relief. There is still that underlying burden that the plaintiff has to prove her case, and she didn't in this case.
So at this point, counsel, if we were to agree with you and then plaintiff brought suit, seeking, you know, asserting an equitable claim or whatever, and seeking the relief that they got, that the plaintiff got here, and a district court, and you would presumably raise, oh, it's not beyond the statute of limitations, but let's say the district court disagreed with that. I mean, then that would be an, that would be, there would be, what would be stopping that? Couldn't the plaintiff just achieve what she wants in a separate suit then if it's within the statute of limitations, given what the district court concluded here?
So, Your Honor, then we would be getting into some re judicata issues. But on top of that, we discussed the statute of limitations, and the statute of limitations runs from the day of April 10th of 2011 in this case. Because
I understand that's your argument, but I'm saying if a court disagreed that that was actually the trigger, the point of the plaintiff missing their balloon payment triggered an obligation for the plaintiff to sue.
Well, Your Honor, that's what the law provides. And I provided multiple cases on the statute of limitations, which says that you cannot just unilaterally determine when the statute of limitations is going to run. It's not when the plaintiff decides to perform. It is when, if she had performed, she had the right to demand performance, full performance of the contract. So in this case, that would have been when she was required to file that balloon, to pay that balloon payment in April of 2011. So that's the cases of Lewis and Weston that we had cited in our brief, as well as Norton, that you cannot just delay the timing of the statute of limitations when you have an obligation to perform and have it go on whenever time you want. And Your Honor, I think that also very much gets into the abandonment issue. And I did want to be able to speak a little bit on the abandonment. So in her brief, Ms. Micken provides this four-factor test on abandonment from Berman. All of the cases that have found abandonment have been with significantly less facts than we have here. So when we've got cases of Lopi, for example, the person was actually there trying to close, and yet they found abandonment. And this was a period of 2 years. Berman was a period of 33 months. Boulevard Plaza was a period of 18 months. Yet in this case here, we have 11 years. There was no effort to pay the balloon payment. In fact, Ms. Micken did not even have any attempt to close. She had not obtained financing. She did not try to obtain financing. To be clear, she testified under oath that she knew she could not obtain financing. And she knew this when she signed the contract for deed. Yet she still did not make any effort to get financing to finish it. And while we did not mention this in our brief, the fact that she knew she could not perform raises issues of fraud. That looks like it's fraud in the inducement when she's signing a contract, which she knows she cannot perform.
But you didn't plead fraud, did you?
We did not. We did not raise that as an issue at all. But it is a concerning factor that was brought up at trial. Your Honor, I've got 10 seconds, so I'll go ahead and rest at this point and then resume with my rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Wolfgram. We'll turn to respondent counsel. Reminder, you're muted if you aren't talking.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. As the trial court noted—
Can you please introduce yourself for our record purposes?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm jumping too quick. My name is Chris Dahlberg with Dahlberg Law Office. I represent the respondent, Julianne Micken. The court correctly noted right from the start that this is a statutory matter. It's a contract for deed cancellation issue. And as the court noted, it may not be waived or contracted around. And the first question the court, I think, was right on is that if you track from the complaint to the order, you can see where we're going is right in the complaint at, for example, paragraph 21 and 22, we're asking, what exactly are the breaches? Tell us what the problems are. And the obligation is not on Ms. Micken in a contract for deed to have to figure out where she's made the mistakes. The duty is through the cancellation statute, the appellants had the duty. So it's been brought up that there somehow was an affirmative duty of Ms. Micken at the time when the balloon payment was to go forward and state her cause. That's not the case. That's not the law. The law is that it was upon the Scheerschmitts, the appellants, they had the duty. And they had noted that they just thought it voluntarily waived. And the court noted that ignorance of the law is not an excuse. Before I do forget, the court also asked about the Torrens, and I think the response was that the court didn't address it, but they did address it in the order. They referred to it that there's a higher burden even there for Torrens property on this. But really what we get to is there's a lot of theories they threw out along the way. And originally they just said, you know, there's breaches, so it's not valid. And as we got into this, we had motions in limine on the abandonment issue. And we said it was pleaded too late. The court did allow it. So there we are. And I think that the bulk of it, I'm just putting aside these statute of limitations and performance issues. I think the court addressed with that correctly. But as the abandonment, the case law is out there. That is one avenue that can go around the Minnesota cancellation statute for contracts. But the court went through every single one of the four elements, and it's been put in the case of application of Berman what the elements were. And so this case was very filled with facts. But on the first factor, it's failure to pay the contract for long periods. And the court went in and said, there's no evidence that was presented that Ms. Micken didn't make payments all along the way. The issue is there were some irregularities there that would have been considered could be breaches. But again, there's no notice or given to it until we get to this controversy at the end that she says, I'm ready to pay this off. And they say, oh, by the way, you had all these breaches in the past. The contract was canceled. That's exactly why the case law says that Minnesota has this statute. The second element is possession. And the court again said the Mickens never were out of that place. They always had possession of the house. The third one is failure to pay the taxes. And again, right from the beginning in our complaint, we said, show us the proof. Where's this problem of the breach? And the court said in its opinion, they said, we have no evidence that the Schierschmitts ever had to pay additional taxes. And actually, they had kind of this convoluted system where they paid into a conduit bank account. It went into the Schierschmitts account, went out through an escrow. It was problematic. That could have been a technical breach, but there was never, I think, that they, by the record, the Schierschmitts didn't even if they knew about it, it wasn't until later, but I do think they knew about it, yet they never gave notice of this property tax issue to the end. And why would they have known about it? Because Miss Micken is a disabled vet, my client. She went and purposely asked for tax reductions, so she got those taxes almost reduced to nothing. What happened with the appellants? They actually, with their escrow account, because there was an existing mortgage when this contract for deed started, they started to get rebates because there was overpayment because Miss Micken had reduced the taxes due to that. She was occupying it. She could only get property taxes reduced as a veteran if she was homesteading and living in that home, and she proved all the records. So again, on the third element of Berman, the taxes, they consistently paid the taxes. And as the trial court note, there's no evidence that the Schierschmitts were having to pay the taxes themselves. Finally, there's this awareness as to the intent of the appellants that they were some time back when the balloon payment was in 2011. And remind you, this is a 10-year period that somehow they had canceled it. Now, the court looked at the testimony, and what the testimony the court found is they said there wasn't clear and convincing evidence either way. And so largely this case is propped up by appellants on the statements of a dead man, Miss Micken's husband, who died due to COVID complications. And in one case, the appellant, Mr. Schierschmitt, testifies about a phone conversation where he had with Mr. Micken. He said, let's just convert this to a tenancy. And the court found that Mr. Schierschmitt's testimony was not credible. Miss Micken, the respondent, testified alternately, and she said, I was working at the police department. I received a call from Mr. Schierschmitt as to this balloon payment being late and what we were going to do about it. And so it was an alternate testimony. And she said, he said, long as we are good on making the payments in the past, we'll just go on with the contract, no changes. And the court found that testimony important. Now, I think important to mention in there is there's one time there's a statement when Mr. Micken is living and he's at a homeowners association meeting. And he states, we're just mere renters. Now, the appellants have said this is evidence that this is, you know, prima facie, this is our case, clear and convincing. But to the court, let's look at what the record was. First, we got the unreliability of a dead man's statement years ago. And actually, one of the witnesses said that heard it. Mind you, what the testimony was is this was in the heat of homeowner association fees being increased, which is never a happy time. And so he makes this rash comment that we can't have him testimony say what happened actually. And the person that testified to hearing it said she thought at the time that was a rather flippant comment. So this is hardly reliable to go back all those years. But more important to the court, it's not what is a subjective intent of the parties. So if the Schierschmitt said it was our intent in our mind that we canceled it, that's not the case. It's what is the facts. And the facts of the record were this. They're trying to maintain from 2011 that the Mickens became mere tenants. Well, here's what the court said as to the facts. They noted there was, for 10 years, if you can imagine, there was never a written lease on that place, even though they said they were now had became landlords. Well, under the statute of frauds, any lease over a year does require a 1 year. The other problematic issue we have is Minnesota has strong laws for protection for spouses that bargain. So how do you have a spouse all of a sudden by an oral agreement with Mr. Schierschmitt, according to his testimony, on a contract for land of a homestead waiving their right without a signature in writing? So that's problematic itself. The other thing with the rental property, there never was, as required by law in this entire 10 years, The Schierschmitts never produced a certificate of rent paid, which is a requirement of law. The other thing is, we had testimony of the City of Duluth Fire and Safety. They said there never was taken out a rental license that would have shown that they were actually, the Schierschmitts were landlords. There was never a rental property inspection of there. The court records show that they never replaced appliances. They never did any maintenance. They never did repairs in 10 years. And probably the most troubling of this comes from Mr. Schierschmidt's testimonies. He acknowledges from 2011, he never reported on his income taxes, rental income, if he was supposedly a landlord. But not only, even more troubling, not only did he not report income taxes from 2011, even if it was a contract for deed, nowhere in his tax returns, and we had the last 4 years, does he even produce that he had rental income. So he just lets that go. And here, if you look at his tax records, here's a man you can see by the trading that's going on. He almost has day trading going on his stocks. He's accounting of his own home as far as equity and interest. So he's very thorough in that. Yet, mysteriously, for 10 years, he forgets about the property up in northern Minnesota and forgets that, oh, I should either report rental income or else I should report contract for deed interest. And in this particular instant, as to his obligation as a landlord, just back as to his obligation of canceling the contract, his answer was, well, I just didn't know I had these legal obligations. And this court can probably guess what the trial court said. Ignorance of the law is not an excuse. And so
So,
at the
may I
end of
ask
the,
you, counsel,
yes.
just as I understand the appellant's fundamental argument is we had no counterclaims, plaintiff failed on her claims, therefore no relief. Is your argument that the relief granted for the respondent is because the issues were functionally tried by consent, or that the relief fit, how do you respond just to that legal argument that unless you can show me the claim in your complaint on which you prevailed, plaintiff, you're entitled to no relief?
Absolutely, they knew, Your Honor. I mean, this has gone on for over a year, and the complaint in itself is clear what we want. As the court noted, there's a contract in existence. What Ms. Mitkin is trying to do is, if there's any defaults, she wants to cure it and pay it. So it was clear all along that they understood this. They were arguing this all along. What they've latched on to is two things. In all of our complaint, we mentioned the word specific performance in the court. Mentions that in their order. And they want to have everything thrown aside, and that we went to the court. And the court said, listen, just because it's not specific performance doesn't mean she doesn't get her relief that she requested of the court. And that was clear in the complaint. And the complaint was a 7-page complaint, very detailed, and it got right to the bottom line. There's a contract for deed, never canceled. We don't have a clue what the breaches were. Let's get this paid, and move on. And so the court answered rightly. And for now, for this to be an excuse at this point, I think you have the case that at the end of the day, what we have is, again, the statute for cancellation of contract for deed. I call it a strong fortress of protection. Yes, in very limited cases, it can be gotten around. I think they've tried probably every single answer they can. But in the end of the day, it just cannot be allowed to let somebody wait, let somebody perform for 10 years, making payments, continuously living and occupying, working on paying for the property taxes, paying the HOA fees. And at the end of the day, they say, oh, by the way, 10 years ago, that contract was canceled. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dahlberg. And Ms. Wolfgram, you'll have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honors. Judge Johnson, I wanted to start with finding the paragraph where specific performance was expressly denied. That was on Addendum 7 at paragraph 38. This was in the first court trial order following the court trials. The court, in its discretion, declines to award plaintiff specific performance as equitable relief in this matter. And specifically, right before that, in paragraph 37, it says that she had come to the court with unclean hands and materially breached the contract at deed in multiple ways, including failure to make the balloon payment. Now, Ms. Mickens' argument has been, I don't like how the appellants proceeded, but we're still at the same fundamental issue. What is the claim? There was no claim that Ms. Micken proved at trial. There was not a breach of contract claim that she proved. She was expressly denied specific performance. The court, in its amended findings, says that the theory is that she's equitably entitled to the property, but the court found she had unclean hands. She wasn't equitably entitled to the property because unclean hands bars equitable relief. And then afterwards, when we moved for a stay of the judgment, the court said that respondent was not a prevailing party by virtue of having succeeded on any claim. So we're at the same spot. The district court acknowledged she did not, Ms. Micken did not prove any claim, but she still awarded relief to Ms. Micken. And the basic law, which Ms. Micken has not disputed, is that a party who fails to prove their claim is not entitled to relief. Now, Your Honors, I wanted to briefly go into one statement that was addressed by Ms. Micken's counsel about that you cannot contract around the statutory cancellation. Now, there's never been an argument that a statutory cancellation was contracted around. It was an inadvertent failure to do the statutory cancellation. But the court has repeatedly said in multiple cases that statutory termination is not the sole mode of terminating a contract for deed. And this court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly also said that there are affirmative defenses to those. So a party who abandons the contract, for example, does not have the right to enforce that contract, even if it was not statutorily canceled. A party who has materially breached it does not have the right to perform that contract, even if it was not statutorily canceled. Your Honor, if there are no additional questions, I would yield my time and just go into my conclusion.
Go ahead.
In conclusion, as this court is aware, it's bound by its precedent, which is established by the Supreme Court, as well as this court's own published opinions. The reality is that you cannot have relief on a claim that you failed to prevail on. That is the precedential law of this court. It is the precedential law in the Minnesota Supreme Court. As an error-correcting court, this court is mandated to reverse and remand because Ms. Micken failed to prove any legal claim. Without any legal claim, the district court erred by granting Ms. Micken relief. For those reasons, we ask that you reverse and remand. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you to both parties. The arguments are helpful in terms of our analysis. The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued in the statutory timeframe.